You are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Beth Pike. And on today's edition, our host, Melvin Merritt, is going to be talking with Christine McDonald. And they'll be talking about the Restoration House, which is a faith-based long-term residential program for survivors of sex trafficking. And then later, Jeff will talk with Latara Smith of KC Freedom Project about how you can make a citizen's complaint if the police break the law or violate your rights. You'll also be able to find our calendar of events on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook or on the KKFI website, because today we have a commentary by Keith Brown L., who is vice president of the Missouri Cure, entitled "The Wrongful Conviction of Innocent People." And that's in the middle of the show. And then at the end, we'll have our 420 drug war news. But coming up after these messages will be Melvin and his guest.
Good morning. Welcome to another live edition of Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1 FM on your dial. I am your host, Melvin Merritt. On the phone as my guest is Miss Christine McDonald. She is a survivor of human trafficking who shares her journey of being rescued from exploitation as a child, which led to nearly two decades of homelessness, street corner prostitution, addiction, and 103 arrests, and seven stints in prison. Christine faces many challenges while putting her life on the right track, including heart-wrenching choice of saving the life of her unborn child over her own eyesight due to an unforeseen illness. She is the author of Cry Purple, which she gives a glimpse of life on the streets, the violence she experienced. Her website is christinesvisions.org. She is now Program Director of Restoration House of Greater Kansas City. That website, restorationhousekc.com. Welcome, Christine McDonald, to Jaws of Justice.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you. You have such an interesting story, and probably one of the first things I'm going to ask is tell us a little bit about that being employed or being exploited as a child that led you to nearly two decades of prostitutions and all types of violence.
Well, you know, trafficking is, of course, the exploitation of vulnerabilities, and I was a runaway and came from a very dysfunctional household, a single mom who had a mental illness and suffered from addiction, and I had kind of run away a number of times, and you know, the system had just continually put me back in that same dysfunction because, you know, we looked at family reunification being the best thing for the families. And then at 15, I had run away, and a man offered me a job and a place to stay. He really earned my trust and became my safe person. And before I know it, within just a matter of time, of weeks, he introduced me to a gentleman as his brother, and before I knew it, his brother owned a series of strip clubs. And at 15, I was given a fake ID that said I was an adult. For me, that was my thoughtful ticket out of being thrust back into the dysfunction of my home life, where there was sexual abuse and physical and emotional trauma. Instead, I was thrust in a world of trafficking, being exploited, and just a whole lot of ugly things. And with that grew an addiction. I'm not sure what came first, the addiction to help with the trauma or the addiction to help with, you know, the experiences. But it became, you know, my coping mechanism, if you will. And then I was used up. It doesn't take long to be used up when you're being exploited. It doesn't take long, especially when you have an addiction. And in a couple of years, you know, I was more hassle than I was worth, used up, as we call it, and left out on the streets.
So we know that, you know, in this lifestyle or this culture, that it led you to about 103 arrests and seven stints in prison. So what was that like?
Yeah, that was in Kansas City. I mean, I think a lot of times when we think about sex trafficking and the purchase of human beings and the buying and selling of people, we don't think about that in our own backyard. It's really a comfortable thing to say this happened somewhere else. But I was on the streets of Kansas City down in the Northeast Corridor along Independence Avenue, Troost, and Prospect for 17 years of that journey once I became an adult and ended up in Kansas City.
Mm. So basically a lot of that activity was along the Independent Corridor.
Absolutely. The majority of it was, yes.
So did this person that you that befriend you, did they introduce you to drugs, or was this something that you did on your own?
I had a lot of dysfunction at home. I would steal alcohol from my family, from my mom, I should say, because I have no idea who my father was, nor did my mom. I would steal alcohol and pills, any pills on the bottle that I saw that had half-closed eyelids. I knew I could sleep through craziness at home. And so I would say that my addiction, you know, my experimentation of drugs, pills, and alcohol began at home. But prior to that, I had been a cutter because of a lot of the dysfunction. In fact, about 8 years old, I started cutting. It was kind of my way of dealing with a lot of trauma, you know, being taken from my family and then put back in the home, and it was still broken. And then I graduated to the alcohol and the pills, and then eventually ended up strung out on cocaine. Cocaine was my drug of choice, and I ended up with a $1,000-a-day crack habit, which that's a lot of dates to feed that habit.
You mentioned cutter. Just for our listening audience, explain what cutter is.
I was a cutter. Okay, so that is self-harm, self-mutilation. You know, when there's a lot of trauma, what we've learned is, you know, we get caught up in the emotional part of the brain that handles emotion, and then we suffer, you know, post-traumatic disorder because of trauma. And what happened for me is for me to get out of that emotional set, cutting was the way that I could kind of connect, you know, me back into the present and out of that emotional connection. So it's kind of how I was able to break the cycle of stuck in trauma. It was just a coping mechanism of me not having the ability or the help that I needed. I really slipped through the cracks on a lot of levels. I think my mother did too. She suffered from a mental illness, and she as well suffered, you know, slipped through the cracks.
Is your mother still around?
She is not. She is not. She is deceased. She died in her addiction.
Okay. During the time of your trafficking, did your caretakers at that time, so to speak, did they allow you to be experience some, you know, drug rehabs, you know, rehab?
I attempted treatment once. It was really kind of funny. I was in Kansas City, and actually a man who had paid for my services, he was an attorney, and he was what we would call out on the streets, the language we would use for him would be a closet smoker. So I don't think his family was aware. He got high and bought prostitutes, which we know, you know, 63% of all buyers of sex, which is what keeps the pimps in business, is the buyers. But he was an attorney, and he would pick me up, you know, every couple of months, and get high, give me his credit card, and let me use his card because he didn't want anybody to know he was getting high. And he told me, he was like, you know, I got to go back home. He said, but, you know, have you ever thought about going to treatment? I said, treatment? What's that? You know, and he explained it to me. I went down to, he dropped me off at a detox center in Kansas City. And they told me that because I didn't drink alcohol, which I didn't drink, I prided myself, and I only did cocaine like there was a better thing. I don't drink. My mom was an alcoholic, and I refused to be her. And they told me I couldn't come in because I couldn't blow a BA, a breathalyzer. So I had to drink to get into detox, and I didn't have insurance, and I was trying to get into this thing called treatment. So I literally left the detox, took off walking. I turned a date to earn money to get dropped off at a liquor store to buy alcohol, asked the guy at the counter, what should I drink if I need to blow a BA? that doesn't taste like booze, and then walked back to the detox center and tried again, and they let me in.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was pretty complicated. And then once I got into treatment, they didn't know what to do with me. I mean, you took the drugs away, but I had all this complex trauma, and I suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, and I had all these things. And once you took the drugs away, it just wasn't enough services for somebody like me that had been victimized since my early childhood.
Has any of this type of outlook in terms that, you know, they're not going to allow you to come in unless that you can blow a breath a lot? Have they changed that, or is that still?
It has changed a little bit. It's not quite the same way. That was in the 90s when I tried it. And, of course, that left me back out on the street for about 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
After that. And, yes, it has changed some. And we are learning that, you know, treatment providers are now learning about trauma informed care, and that's understanding that more likely than not, trauma has been a part of individuals' journeys through addiction, whatever that addiction journey looked like. There has been some sort of trauma, which gives them some sensitivity. They still have a long ways to go to understand all the resources outside of them, and that, you know, collaborating is always important to get, you know, the full gamut of services. I mean, for me, when they took the drugs away, I began cutting again, and I hadn't cut since I was a little kid because the drugs numbed all of that for me. It was my scapegoat, if you will. And then once we took the drugs away, because I wasn't getting, you know, some other psychological support I needed for the post-traumatic stress disorders and the complex compound trauma, I was cutting again. And for me, I walked out and decided that I'd rather get high than self-mutilate.
Mm. So tell us a little bit, tell us a little bit about that seven-year stint in the penitentiary.
Well, it was seven trips to prison. The longest I ever did was I did 17 months in the county, and then I did 3 years in prison. So I ended up being about 5 years altogether. What was that like for me? Well, time stands still in prison. We've come a long ways with the Missouri Department of Corrections. I mean, we still have a long ways to go. We've developed the Missouri Reentry Process, which is a collaborative effort between community organizations, probation, parole, Department of Corrections, and private sectors, you know, people that own businesses and people in the community to understand that we really, if we create opportunities for offenders to reintegrate, we really create safer communities, you know, for the people around us by helping them. But, you know, at the time I was in and out of prison, we were still very much on the punishment level, and rehabilitation was not a part of the Department of Corrections journey for me. It was like I went there, time stood still, but I was still very broken. So when I would come back out, I would just kind of go back to the same old thing. I went to a halfway house the first time, and there I had two former pimps of mine that were housed in the same DOC halfway house center, which made me feel very vulnerable. I felt very intimidated and very vulnerable. So for me, at that time, I decided that it was probably best that I not be there because I felt trapped, and so I went back out and got back out on the streets kind of as a renegade because I didn't want to be back in that same trap, and then just kind of ended up back in the cycle of the prison system.
Let's go ahead on and turn the corner. In case anyone that just tuned in, we're talking with Miss Christine McDonald's, and she survived the sex trafficking, and now she is the program director at Restoration House, and she's also an author of Cry Purple, and that gives us an insight if you get the book, and you can find that probably on Christine's website, which is christinesvision.org. And let's get into where you're at now in terms of the Restoration House. Tell us a little bit about this Restoration House.
Well, Restoration House is a faith-based, we're a faith-based organization, but we're a long-term residential and therapeutic home for adults women that have been trafficked and that are leading lives of prostitution. So we have a home where they live. Everything is free of charge for our women as long as they need to be there. We're very individualized, so every case looks different. What their needs are different. And we have a place where we provide we have trauma counseling, we have group classes, we have exercise classes, yoga, music therapy, and then they have a home. They have a home where they live in community together with each other as they're trying to restore their lives. And we provide everything free of service through assistance through the community.
Yeah, we have talked about some of the dark sides of your life, but you tremendously turned your life around because, as I read your bio, you have received numerous honors and awards and have overcame your past and claimed your place in the future. You know, I know you don't want to toot your own horn, but I was just amazed when I read this and that all the places that you've gone thus far, you know, in the positive sense, and you've also have been featured on PBS and CBS and Fox and NPR. And I know that this story is about the Restoration House as well, but I needed to shine some light on the positive side of Christine McDonald.
Well, thank you. That's very sweet. You know, I think one of the biggest joys of all of those things are a couple of things. One is being a program director of Restoration House, which is in Kansas City, and we serve the greater Kansas City area. And that's where I was on the streets for so long, and there was no services for people like me. I didn't fit in the box. I remember going to an organization that serves specifically people coming out of prison with multiple arrests, and they told me that my history was too jaded. I had too many reoffenses, and that I didn't fit in their box because they needed people that would be successful. So I was pretty much deemed unrehabilitated, which is kind of crazy. And I mean, after I went to college and got a GED, I learned that unrehabilitatable isn't even a word. But she was the person that was the head of the organization, and you know, they're trying to get grant funding. And so even though I was asking for help, I was denied that help because they figured I was just too all messed up. So being in the same community where I was and serving some of the same women coming from the very lifestyles that I have, it's just like God bringing everything full circle. Where all my pain and trauma was, I am able to offer hope and restoration for those individuals where there hasn't been before.
Did any of these ladies that you are helping now, did they recognize you from the past?
I have been able to run into a few of the women from my past, which has been really great. It's really nice because, you know, they can identify to see where I was when I was at my worst and to see me now being where I am. I think that gives them some hope where they hadn't had any before.
So with the Restoration House, and I understand that the Restoration House collaborate with other nonprofit organizations. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yes. No one service provider can provide all the services we need. We partner. We're all about the victimization of these women has come, you know, and oftentimes they feel like the lowest of the low on the social economic totem pole, and they been denied services, and they just don't fit in typical boxes. So we're all about collaboration. We collaborate with Rediscover for outpatient services. We partner with Dixmas House for outpatient for some of our participants. We also collaborate with One by One Ministries.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about
organization as well.
Tell us a little bit about that One by One project. I found that interesting.
Okay. Yeah, One by One, they're amazing. They're a education and community awareness organization, and they host different events across the community. They do an annual volleyball event where people come in, and then they donate proceeds of that, and they help support Restoration House. They're just really awesome. They have a golf event coming up really soon, and with that, part of the proceeds will come to support Restoration House of Greater Kansas City.
And you said that the Restoration House is a long-term recovery, so to speak, place where women can come in and come out of the craziness, so to speak, on the streets. So
yes.
What does all that entail when a woman comes in, say, for the first time?
Well, first of all, we explain to them, we're asking them to give a minimum of a year to their own recovery. You know, it doesn't take overnight to get messed up, and it doesn't, I mean, and you don't get fixed in a day. But that journey is number one, we call them participants and not clients. Participants because there is that expectation that they will participate in their own healing process. We have a trauma therapist they meet with twice a week to work on some of those hurts. And for many times what we learn is many of these individuals were trafficked as minors. And then they're in the life of prostitution as minors that are never identified or recovered. And then they become adults at 18 and magically they're punitively identified as prostitutes, and they're not still looked at as trafficking victims. I mean, we still have a long ways to go. But they go through during the day. They have art therapy. They have exercise classes. We provide them transportation to their appointments. We can connect them with vocational rehabilitation services if they choose to go to school to help facilitate payments for that, as well as, you know, sometimes they want job placement services. And after they've been in the program for about 90 to 120 days, depending on the individual, they'll be looking for jobs in the community so that by the time they're ready to go, they do are not only healthy, hopefully emotionally, and physically, but they're at a place where they can sustain their own lives in the community as productive, tax-paying, healthy, lovely, amazing individuals that God has meant them to be.
What is the connection with Restoration House and Children Mercy Hospital?
Well, we just did a training there last week where we talked about what does trafficking look like and what are some of the symptoms. Trafficking can be such a complex thing. So we were invited in to do a training. My executive director, September Tribble, facilitated that training just to open the doors to understand the variable symptoms that could be a sign of a much bigger issue, such as sex trafficking. And so we have, we are collaborating with them to educate their emergency room staff, their doctors, their nurses, to help them ask some different questions, look for the signs, and to be educated so that maybe we can identify more individual victims, you know, before, you know, that they have been caught up in this any longer.
Just in case anyone is interested, could you give the website to Restoration House?
Yes, they can find more about Restoration House at restorationhousekc.com. And you can like us on Facebook. We have the third Thursday of every month, we have a public community awareness and education night at the Heart of Life Church in Lee's Summit. And we serve dinner, and we always have a different theme. And it's also where you can come in and figure out maybe you want to be a volunteer. We have volunteer packets there. There's a large screening process to become a volunteer to ensure the safety, of course, for those we serve. We would just love to, you know, collaborate. If you're touched by this or want to learn more, it's restorationhousekc.com. And you can also like us on Facebook and see what's going on and sign up and register for our third Wednesday of the month community education awareness events.
Thank you very much. Christine McDonald is who we have been talking with, and we are at the bottom of the hour, so I am so grateful to have met with you and talked with you, and you just keep right on keeping on, and so have a great, great day.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on here. Have a great day.
You too now.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. And my name is Beth Pike. It's just now about 9:26. And I invite you to listen in next week to Jaws of Justice Radio when we are going to return to the interview from Keith Brown L. that was conducted with Max Parthas of Abolitionist Radio about modern-day slavery and the prison industrial complex and his effort to eliminate the conviction exception in the 13th Amendment. But this time, next week, we'll be playing the whole interview. We do have a little portion of an interview we're going to play now, and then we'll be getting to Jeff and his guests.
Good morning. My name is Keith Brown Hill, and the name of my commentary for today is entitled Watermelon Man 2015. The ideas being expressed herein are solely my own opinions and do not reflect the views of the staff and management here at KKFI, Jaws of Justice Radio, or the Mid-Coast Radio Project. Sometimes I wonder about all of these crazed gunmen we keep hearing about on the news. Are they really the kind of psychotic, delusional, and unprovoked killers we are being told by the media that they are? Or are they just normal, everyday people who have simply been pushed to a breaking point after being driven into a state of angry and hopeless desperation? Some people would argue that these murder-suicides, for which these gunmen are often responsible, are proof that they must have had some kind of serious mental defect. But to me, murders followed by suicide do not automatically constitute proof that these people were in fact really crazy. It could very well be that these folks were still sane enough to realize what was about to happen to them after they committed these murders. So they simply chose to end their own lives instead of receiving brutal ass whippings upon being arrested. The absolute certainty of a lifetime of mistreatment and suffering in prison, or being summarily executed on the spot by police, or maybe being found dead in a jail cell under mysterious circumstances after they got to the station. It's probable that the most dignified and rational thing these suspects felt that they could do is take their own lives and cheat this rotten-ass, no-good, mentally defective system out of its revenge. I call it a desperate reaction to a hopeless, unjust society. The most recent example of this occurred in Roanoke, Virginia, involving a former news reporter who gunned down two of his previous co-workers on live TV and then allegedly committed suicide. His name was Vester Lee Flanagan, also known as Bryce Williams, and I believe there is more to his story than what we have been told so far. Credible people who knew Flanagan personally say that the image the media is trying to associate with him was not the man they knew. According to our trustworthy and reliable media, however, and Mr. Flanagan's adversaries, he was a troubled individual who had experienced problems with fellow employees everywhere he worked. Admittedly, he was a gay black man who was described as someone who was overly sensitive about his race and his sexuality to the point of being sociopathic. He ultimately resorted to violence, they say, because he felt that he was harassed, discriminated against, and fired because of his race and sexual preferences. The violence committed by him was triggered, for lack of a better term, when he came to work one day and found a watermelon sitting on an ice chest out in the hallway. But I can easily understand how coming to work and finding something like this in a place where it should not be may have made him feel in that kind of environment. To some black people, watermelons are still an unpleasant and offensive reminder of what our ancestors had to endure when they were in slavery. We will probably never know Flanagan's real reasons for committing these two murders. We don't know if what we have been told about this incident is true or not. Killing two people and then oneself for the reasons we have been given does seem rather senseless, but we don't know what else these two former co-workers may have done to cause themselves to be selected by Flanagan as targets. The one thing we do know is that given the current atmosphere of racism and homophobia in our society, it is not all that hard to imagine that other and more outrageous acts of antagonism towards Flanagan may have also occurred, of which we are unaware of at the present time. Whether Vester Flanagan's grievances were real or imaginary, many of the evils being talked about herein are very real. Flanagan was apparently painfully aware of this, and that may be why he got fed up and did the only thing he could do, take matters into his own hands. There is no doubt that he was the one who pulled the trigger and took the lives of these two people. Yet it was this society's shameless, self-righteous, and unrepentant racist attitudes and homophobia which fashioned Mr. Flanagan into the powder keg that eventually caused him to explode. So now the question is, how long will it be before we see this and other incidents like this again? My name is Keith Brown Eel, and thank you for listening.
Welcome back to Jaws of Justice Radio, and with that impassioned plea, we're going to go into a subject that's not too far off from that, actually. My guest today is Latara Smith. She's director of KC Freedom Project. Latara has been on before, and we're bringing her back because she's got some real good information for folks that feel like the system has treated them poorly or incorrectly. So welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a blessing to be here.
And I guess I should also remind people that my name is Jeff Humfeld. So anyway, Latara, let's talk a little bit about this. First off, I do need to let our listeners know that we did ask someone from the Office of Citizens Complaints to come in, but because of timing and everything else, they were not able to come in today. We will have them on at a later date. But we do want to talk about how people make a complaint if they think the police have done something wrong, violated their rights, or maybe gotten, you know, a little bit too frisky with them, or you know, and some of the other things that you can look at police activity on, and you know, to hold them accountable, because mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that we see here too much in our society right now, is that the police are not being held accountable, and they're not policing us in the way that we as citizens want them to.
Right, right, right. Well, the original complaint process would start with an individual contacting the, here in the Kansas City, you know, Metroplex would be to contact the KCPD Office of Citizen Complaints. That would be your first stop, okay? Their complaint process, if you go to the Kansas City Police Department website and go to Office of Citizen Complaints, it clearly tells you the specifics, the rules and regulations to submitting a complaint, okay? You can also do that from the convenience of your own home. If you have access to a printer and a scanner, you can actually print off their complaint form. You can fill it out in the PDF form, print it off, and then you can scan it and send it back in via email. Now, a lot of people may not have that type of access at home. So if you don't, those forms can also be mailed in. But if you mail those forms in, they have to be notarized. Okay. The only exception to them not being notarized is if you submit them online. And this is according to their website. Okay. Their rules and regulations on their website states that, you know, you only have 90 days from the date of the occurrence that the misconduct happened. The police misconduct can be reported to various agencies in the community as well as there at any police station. Those agencies are, one of them is ad hoc. I believe there is a Missouri CAN, I believe. I really can't recall them all, but if you refer to their website, it gives you three or four places within the community that you can file those complaints to. And not only does it have to be 90 days from the date of the occurrence, it also states that currently the website states that there can be no third-party entries of complaints, which to me that's kind of an issue. If you're incarcerated and you don't have access to, let's say you're in there and you have a very high bond, and we all know that if you have an high bond, you're going to go back and forth to court a few times sometimes before that bond is lower to where you can get out. So if that complaint is no one can make it for you third party and you actually have to be the one to go in there and make it, if you're incarcerated, how do you make it within those 90 days? Because you may not be out within those 90 days. Now, at a hearing back here on the 21st, I believe, of last month, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights held a public hearing here in Kansas City, which I attended that hearing. And during that hearing, there was representatives from the Office of Citizens Complaints that spoke and said that, you know, there's representatives that are in the jail on a regular basis that take these complaints. You know, I've had a few complaints that have come in where people said, no, that's not true. you know, I don't know, but they did say that is a process that they have in place now where they are in the jail on a regular basis taking these complaints. They also did say that they were addressing their policy for changes in reference to the third-party submission of complaints, that they were reviewing that at the time. But currently, according to their website, as of this morning, when I looked at it last at 7:30, it still stated that they did not accept third-party complaints. So,
okay. Let's talk a little bit about the types of complaints that can be made, because I think most people think, all right, they violated my rights, and you know, we've had plenty of lawyers in here telling people if they violate your rights on the street, that's not the place to complain, or the trying to get in their face about you can't do that, you know, you need to take that to court, or you need to make that complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of things, you know, on the street, let's say, if you're stopped by police, would you expect that people could make a complaint about?
Well, I think what I see most times is people know that something is wrong, or they've been, you know, mistreated, or there has been some type of violation of their rights. But if you cannot connect that to what the law says, you know, to a Missouri state statute, then it's kind of hard, you know, to a certain extent for you to prove that. For example, in one of the cases that I'm working on, the case of Keith Carnes, you know, there was issues where there was a lot of police misconduct in the homicide investigation that led to his wrongful conviction. So, you know, if you have police misconduct in cases, you need to take it back to, you know, which is kind of hard if you don't know about the law. This is why it's so very important that we as a community, we as a people, educate ourselves. Because, you know, what I did was able to track it to the law and show that these police officers committed this particular misconduct according to the law. So then that's when you go, first step, Office of Citizen Complaints, you make them aware of what has happened. And if you make your complaint with the Office of Citizen Complaints and you don't feel that it's been handled satisfactorily, then what you're going to do then is look at what other options you have, which is you can go on to the Missouri Department of Public Safety. If you have officers that have committed misconduct and the Office of Citizen Complaint did not address it accordingly, well, every police officer in the state of Missouri holds what's called a peace officer license. And if they have done something that goes against the standards of having that peace officer license, then I highly suggest that you all contact the Missouri Department of Public Safety and file your complaint with them and see if your complaint is legitimate and you can back it up with law and show exactly what these officers did or show what they did to be unethical according to KCPD policy, protocol, and procedure. Then what happens is there stands a chance they can get their license disciplined or they can get it removed. The director of the Department of Public Safety, which is, I believe, Elaine Roberts, has the authority to do so. But there again, it goes back to we, the people, the community, educating ourselves on what we can do.
You know, one of the things that I think a lot of people in Kansas City don't quite get, and that is that in Kansas City's case, and I'm not sure whether St. Louis is still under it. We're the only two police forces or whatever in the country that are actually under the purview of the state rather than locally.
Exactly.
And so that, you know, that step of going to the state is a really important one in Kansas City, Missouri in particular.
It is. It most definitely is. And then also every police department, they have a law enforcement accreditation. So there again, there's certain standards that the police department has to operate by in order to maintain that law enforcement accreditation. So, you know, these are things that we need to start addressing and reaching out to. If you submit complaints to KCPD, Office of Citizens Complaints, and you don't feel that they addressed it, you know, accordingly, then you need to go to the next step. You most definitely need to go to the next step. There, you know, there were some issues in reference to myself and another individual, Mr. Simmons. We went to turn our complaints into ad hoc, okay, which is you know, formerly the president of Ad Hoc is Alvin Brooks. And the reason we went there is because, like I said, the website clearly tells you that if your misconduct is past 90 days from the date of the occurrence, then they won't hear those. And this is according to the website. So if I have an issue and I'm finding out about police misconduct, like in the case of Mr. Carnes with his wrongful conviction, and now 10-11 years later, we find out all this police misconduct, then I'm not going to waste my time going to the Office of Citizens Complaints if their website is telling me I can't after 90 days. I'm going to go directly to the KCPD Board of Commissioners because they govern the Office of Citizens Complaints. So upon going and meeting with Mr. Brooks in the Ad Hoc's office and saying, bringing the issues of this police misconduct to his attention, you know, I don't feel that it was handled fairly. You know, we were told, hey, it's nothing you can do. It's past 90 days. We're not going to address it. You know, you've come to the wrong place. We're not going to address this. And you're like, well, okay, so where do I go? If you are the president of the KCPD Board of Commissioners and you all govern the Office of Citizens Complaints, then who do I go to make this complaint? You know, so that's when I said, okay, well, Lord, you show me. And then there you go. You send your complaints to higher agencies. But you always want to start with the proper chain of command. If it's the OCC, send it anyway. You know, if it's within 90 days, send it. If not, you can address it to the board. But you need to follow the proper chain of command.
Okay. You spoke about the law and the statutes that govern officers and their conduct.
Yes.
Where would somebody begin to find those particular statutes? And where would they look to find the information if they think something's happened wrong and they want to see whether that's really a violation or not?
Okay. If you refer to the revised Missouri statutes 575, if you just Google that much, 575 point, Missouri statutes 575 point, it's going to pull up. Just put all the statutes that fall under that division there, and you can clearly see. For an example, if you have a police officer, well, I'm not going to go there because I don't want to specifically go into Mr. Carnes' case, but I will say in his case there were several police officers who committed Class D felonies, okay? And, you know, of course we know that Mr. Carnes is wrongfully convicted as a result of some prosecutorial misconduct as well as now what has come to our attention, police misconduct as well. So if you go to that Missouri statutes 575 and just thoroughly read them and go through, you'll find them. And 9 times out of 10, you're going to find something that is going to be relevant to your situation that you'll be able to stand upon and rely upon that particular statute.
Okay, well, that's good information to know. And I hope that people actually do, you know, if they've got a complaint, do actually go to the statutes and understand what the complaint, you know, what the statute is behind the complaint. So when they do make their complaint, they have that documentation, they have that information.
Right, right.
And that's the other thing is document, document, document. You know,
document,
write down when you talk to somebody, write down.
Document who you talk to, the time you spoke with them. And I always say this, establish you a paper trail in black and white. That's the first thing they taught us in law classes. Establish you a paper trail in black and white. So if you're going to submit a complaint through OCC and let's say you don't have access, you know, some people utilize the library, you know, to use their computers. Well, you can't scan and copy and attach an email from a library. But what you can do is you can print off your PDF form after you fill it out, and you can utilize a fax machine, call OCC, get their fax number, and fax that complaint over. And now if you fax it over, you would have to also retain a notary, okay, according to their website. But you want to fax it, and you want to keep your fax confirmation to show, to create your paper trail of when you submitted this complaint. It's going to give you, a fax confirmation, and you have that, you know, to show it. Or you can send it certified mail, sign upon receipt. But there again, most times finances are limited. So I would say, you know, fax it would be the cheaper route to go to give you a legitimate confirmation.
Okay. My name is Jeff Humfeld, and I want to remind you that you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio. And my guest today is Latara Smith, director of KC Freedom Project. And while we're saying that, why don't you tell people how they can get a hold of you?
Sure, sure. Our website is www.kcfreedomproject.org, or you can reach us. Our main number is 816-456-9776.
Okie doke, and we'll repeat that at the end. So if you didn't get all of that, we'll do that again. But all right, we have talked a little bit about the you know, how people find the statutes, how people decide whether they've been wronged, where they go, and all. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what your group does, and some more about what kind of you know, give us some for instances of violations that the police may make that
sure.
Most people wouldn't even think about.
Right. Well, the KC Freedom Project is a ministry, and what we do is we work to help vindicate and exonerate those that are wrongly convicted. We are an advocacy group, okay? So what we are is what I always say, we are the gap standers. We stand in the gap to help these individuals that are wrongly convicted because, as you know, when you're incarcerated, you're limited as to what you can do, what you can't do, who you can contact, who you can reach out to, or whatever. So that is what we do, okay? For example, if some people don't understand what I meant when I said the Missouri State statutes, they can call me and they can tell me their situation over the phone, and I'll refer them to what statute that, you know, more than likely was, you know, violated. And in reference to the second part of your question there, let's say, for example, I can clearly say in Mr. Karn's case, I will go ahead and say this. When you have witnesses that are interviewed, in Mr. Karn's case, there were two eyewitnesses that testified against him in this wrongful conviction. Well, when you have police officers or detectives that interview witnesses in any cases, and those witnesses have felony warrants for their arrest, and those police officers fail to execute that arrest, they interview them. They send their street officers out to pick them up on a pickup order. They bring them back to the detective station, police station, then they question them. When they question them and take a statement, and the street officers take them back, and none of them, neither the detective nor the police officers that transported them, arrest that witness when that witness the whole entire time had a felony warrant, then that is what you call a failure to execute an arrest warrant, and that is a violation of the Missouri State Statutes 575.180.1, which is a Class D felony. So in cases where you have police officers that are interviewing these witnesses, and these witnesses are, you know, they have felony warrants, KPS warrants for their arrest, and they fail to execute those warrants, because you have to understand a warrant is a court-ordered document by a judge that says arrest or apprehend this individual, any peace officer in the state of Missouri. So when they fail to do that, then they defy a judge's court order. That's a Class D felony for a police officer, okay? So if I broke the law and violated a state statute, or you, Jeff, did it, we're going to be charged, we're going to be arrested, we're going to have to make a bond, and we're going to have to bail out. So why is it any difference when a police officer does that? They should be held under the same responsibilities that we have as citizens, because they're supposed to be law-abiding citizens.
All right. Isn't that one of the responsibilities underneath that would be included underneath their application and their license as a peace officer?
Of course. Of course. They are supposed to be truthful and honest. Okay. If you refer to the KCPD's policy and ethics of code and ethics for police officers, it's all there. It states they're supposed to be honest. Okay. And that's not being honest. That's not being honest at all, because 9 times out of 10, I don't know. I'll say, if this was me, if I had a warrant for my arrest and you pick me up for questioning, that would be a little pressure on me to cooperate with you. Okay.
Yeah.
Especially if you're going to let me go. If you're going to let me go. That would be pressure on me, okay? So, you know, it is what it is. But we're going to see how the KCPD is going to respond to these misconduct, to these complaints. Let's just see what they do, because they will be submitted this week.
We only have a couple minutes left.
Sure.
You know, one of the things I get from what you're saying is that, you know, in today's atmosphere where people are really looking at the way the police conduct themselves and stuff, and we as citizens quite often feel like we're powerless to, you know, to do something about it. It's refreshing to hear that there actually are rules and regulations and things there. It's just a matter of using them and, you know, to make the police force act in the way that we feel that we need them to keep us safe in our community and keep us safe from you know, being violated within our community.
Right.
Once again, I want you to give your phone number and the website and let people know exactly, you know, how they can get a hold of you and what they might call you for.
Sure. It's www.kcfreedomproject.org. Our contact number is 816-456-9776. And you all are more than welcome to contact me with any questions in reference to police misconduct. We've held one community complaint form, and we will be having another.
Okay. And folks, this is Jeff Humfeld once again, and this is Jaws of Justice Radio. And my guest today has been Latara Smith, director of KC Freedom Project. And I do expect that we're going to have you back somewhere down the road again and talk about some more of this because I think this is something that people want to hear and want to know about.
Yes, I would love to come back. Like I said, I'm curious to see how KCPD is going to handle these complaints that are being submitted to the office about the police misconduct that was committed in the Carnes case.
Well, I am too. It should be really interesting. And we want to thank you once again for coming in and let our people know that our listeners know that the 420 Drug War News is up next.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Here I'm speaking with the director of A New Path, Gretchen Burns Bergman.
It's A New Path, and the PATH stands for Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing. And we actually started in 1999 at the time that I had a son who had addiction problems, and he had been incarcerated for possession of marijuana, which started an 11-year cycling in and out of jail prison as his addiction developed. He actually learned to shoot heroin behind bars. So we knew, and it was a group of, there were three parents that started this, we knew that our kids weren't not getting the help that they needed, but instead they were being treated by a criminal justice system that absolutely exacerbated the problem and really stole years of their life, and in some cases, you know, it led to, you know, overdose deaths and loss of, you know, if you've been convicted of a felony, loss of all kinds of rights, including sometimes housing and education and that kind of thing. So we started with the idea of therapeutic justice. We wanted to treat rather than incarcerate, and then it developed a whole host of more harm reduction strategies that reduce the harm rather than criminal policies, and developed a deep belief that we have to stop stigmatizing people for using drugs or for being addicted to drugs, and that we have to stop criminalizing them. Certainly, we're losing generations of people to mass incarceration and to overdose deaths because so many people are afraid to call 911. We started in 2010 a national campaign called Moms United to End the War on Drugs as a way of really expanding our work and working with partners, family members, mothers, and others who were doing this work or who were of like mind and needed a vehicle to really speak out. And we're seeing that parents are really making some changes by not sitting by silently as our families and our loved ones are being destroyed, lives are being destroyed, but instead speaking out. So that's the nature of the organization: stop the stigmatization, criminalization of people who use drugs or who develop problems with drugs. Our website is www.momsunited.net. And you can link to the PATH website through that.
Once again, that was Gretchen Burns Bergman, a very brave woman, trying to stop these needless deaths of our youngsters across America. Again, that website, momsunited.net. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.